The first time they gave us something to eat was on the 27th day. I was just hopping on one leg. They didn't care that you were on one leg. They didn't give a damn. They beat you just like everyone else. We knew how each of them beat us. We knew that today we'd get it more or less lightly, but tomorrow we'd have to toughen up a bit, because tomorrow they'd beat us much harder.
Hello everyone, this is the True War Crime Podcast, and in today's episode my guest is Oleksandr Avramenko. He holds my personal record for the number of prisons he's been transferred to. Although, of course, this isn't some kind of competition or achievement worth striving for. But indeed, this man was transferred to 12 different prisons during the 1,152 days he spent in Russian captivity. And that is, so far, the highest number I've heard from the guys I've spoken with, not only in previous episodes, but in various situations in general. Hello, Sasha. Tell me, how are you doing after returning from captivity? How is your mental and emotional state in general? Let's put it this way. How much have you adapted to normal life?
Good afternoon. I've almost adapted, but I'm still undergoing rehabilitation and treatment. And I'm trying to get my bearings a little. I try, of course, to get out of the city more often so I'm not in crowded places. I go to the countryside more often, to the Carpathian Mountains, where there's beautiful nature and the chance to relax.
You're one of the few people I've spoken with on the podcast who joined the armed forces of Ukraine, not in 2022, but back in 2014. If I'm not mistaken, you also participated in the ATO, even though you were a civilian before that, as I understand it.
Yes, in 2014, when it all began, I had a classmate. I'm from Vinnytsia myself, and he was a fellow townsman. He was doing his mandatory service in Donetsk and stayed there via signing a contract with AFU. At some point in 2014, his father called me and said he had been killed. Fortunately, he was able to retrieve his son's body, and we buried him in Vinnytsia. Somewhere on the second or third day, I took my military documents and went to the military registration and the enlistment office as a volunteer.
Was that a trigger for you?
Yes. At the time, a separate 90th battalion was being formed within the 95th brigade. Our first task was to defend the Donetsk airport. So until January 21st, 2015, the date we left the airport, my brigade and battalion were stationed there.
So, does that mean you're one of the cyborgs? Is that right? For those listening to our podcast who may not understand what we're talking about, in 2014, just as the first wave of Russian aggression against Ukraine began, there was a highly symbolic site in the Donetsk region, Donetsk Airport. There were very fierce battles there, and the soldiers who were stationed there who defended Donetsk Airport are called cyborgs in Ukraine. Back then, there was this very powerful message. The cyborgs held out, but the concrete didn't. It's a very honorable title, and indeed a very honorable chapter in our history. So right at the start of our conversation, I want to thank you for taking part in all of that back then, for holding our ground. And I suspect that not all of your comrades probably made it back from the airport.
Yes, not everyone did. Many were left behind and many were taken prisoner at the time. Thank God they were released and exchanged, but so many died back then.
The reason I decided to move on to this topic is that the war from 2014 to 2022, so they say, was one war. But from 2022 until now, it's like a different war. Although it seems to me that in recent years, say 2022, 2023, 2024, and so on, we've practically had a new war every year because the means of destruction are changing significantly. And the number of these means of destruction is changing on our side and on the enemy side. So from your perspective, between the war back then and the one now, what do you see as the difference?
The difference now is huge, but I was still there when there was direct contact. That is when you are on the front lines and you see the enemy. When I returned from captivity and started watching videos, started talking to the guys, I saw that the war has changed a lot, and now it's almost not people fighting, but machines.
How do you see this? Is it good or bad?
It's technological progress that was bound to happen one way or another, but this development is now gaining momentum very, very rapidly. I understand that it saves lives and that fewer guys might die because of it. Only drones can get damaged here. And whereas we used to see each other, now you're operating at a very great distance from the front lines where only drones are fighting.
So you were taken prisoner in early 2022 on April 15th?
April 15th, when Mariupol was already almost completely under siege. We had withdrawn from Mariupol itself to the Ilitch plant, which we were defending to prevent the enemy from taking it.
Sorry to interrupt. I'm not asking about how it all happened there, but about the fact that you were captured at the start of the war and all this technological progress passed you by. You see how much everything has changed. Do you see yourself in that new format of war now or not?
I do, if I could continue doing professionally what I'm good at.
Is that kind of work still needed?
It's still needed, but my health doesn't allow for it. I still need a lot of time to recover from captivity.
Now, watching how our military is fighting, what tactics they're using, what they're doing, what feelings does that evoke in you? Are you proud of where we've come? Could things have been better? How do you view this progress in general?
I am proud of my guys who are defending Ukraine and continue to do so. I have comrades who have been with me since 2014. One of them is still fighting. He switched from a military career to becoming a drone operator, trained and continues to fight. Ever since I returned from captivity, I've been constantly helping them with spare parts for vehicles and drones. I buy them myself and send them to the guys myself because there isn't enough of this kind of support. Volunteers play an important role, just as they did before. The government can't keep up with providing everything that's needed.
As far as I know, the situation may vary across different units, but there are indeed some units that are less well known. I can't say for sure, I don't have the full picture. I know that the supply situation differs from unit to unit. In some places, only volunteers can provide support. In others, the government steps in. It's all different in reality. Subscribe, like, and click the bell icon so you don't miss the next episode. Okay, let's move on to your story of being taken prisoner. You were in Mariupol. As I understand it, you were trying to break out of there, right?
Yes, we attempted the breakout on April 12th, but it failed. Two jets that took off from Russia bombed the front of our convoy as it was trying to break through. That cut us off from the rest of the convoy, and we were left at the factory. We stayed there until April 13th and tried another breakout, which also failed. Then we decided to leave in separate groups so that at least one group could reach the evacuation point. When my group set out, we escorted them and, so to speak, went ahead of the group to cover them. When we reached a certain point, there was an ambush there. We drew their fire onto ourselves while the main group moved a little further ahead. It so happened that we got so far behind that the main group was already very far away, and the two of us were walking behind them, finding ourselves behind enemy lines. When we were walking on April 15th, we left Mariupol, almost reached Klibodarivka, but got into the enemy, an ambush we hadn't noticed. That's how we were captured, and the main group was further away, much further away.
Did they break through?
Unfortunately not. They were also captured even before we were. We didn't know that at that time because we had no communication, we didn't have radios. And when we fell into the ambush, there were just the two of us, while there were more than 10 to 15 Russians there. We realized that the two of us wouldn't be able to win that battle, especially since we had almost no ammunition or provisions left. We had to surrender. They gave us time to think, and during that time, we were able to unload our automatic rifles, rendering them inoperable. We removed the firing pins from the rifles, disassembled and discarded the grenades, and surrendered. At first, they didn't touch us and transported us to the first location. It was a village, a police station in the village. There, an hour after they brought us in, the beatings, torture, stripping us of our uniforms, and everything else began. The first time they gave us anything to eat was on the 27th day.
The 27th day after you were taken into captivity, and before that?
Before that, we only had water. They gave just 1 5-liter jug of some kind of water for the 20 of us sitting in the cell. It wasn't really fit to drink, but we had to drink it.
There was no choice.
The first time we actually ate was when we arrived at the prison in Olenivka. That was the first prison we were taken to. I don't remember the date anymore. They brought us there, and that's where our first intake took place. It was truly terrifying because I had never seen a corridor like that before. I had no idea what an intake was. They crammed so many people in there.
How did that happen? Please describe it. How many people were in the corridor?
There were about 30 people in the hallway. They were standing on both sides. Everyone had some kind of weapon. Some had bats, some had batons, some just had boxing gloves, and some had kickboxing gear. And they force you to run with your head down while they beat you from all sides. They were standing very tightly packed, very close to each other.
Could you dodge them somehow?
If you start dodging, they hit you even harder, shove you to the side, and just beat you there with sticks. Then you run to the end, where they strip you. Then you keep running to the next stage. And the next stage is more beatings, but you're already almost completely stripped down. You're only wearing underwear. Then they look at your tattoos and your overall appearance. After that, they take you to a cell.
Do you have any tattoos that caught their attention?
Yes, I have a wolf tattoo on my chest, and also for the Airborne Forces tattoo that was done a very, very long time ago on my wrist.
Did they react to that?
Yes.
How? What did they say?
During the first interrogation, they shocked the wolf tattoo with a stun gun and beat my hand with the baton. They put me on the table, held my hand down, and beat it with the baton. Because when I told them my rank and position, they didn't believe me. They were surprised. No, how is that possible? Who fought in Mariupol? We lost 22 battalions and one regiment, and there were only 500 or 700 of you there. They said they didn't understand how it was possible, why it happened, and who was actually fighting there. Whoever we take, he's either a cook, a driver, or someone from the support staff, they complained. We were foolishing them. At that time in Mariupol, my entire brigade was deployed, and only a few people remained in my battalion, the ones who were, so to speak, the wild ones, who liked a little alcohol, might smoke a little weed. They weren't taken into combat, they stayed in the rear. I was on the front line, what we call at zero. And then when it all started, the battalion commander sent me to those guys, to the rear. The commander said, "You'll take charge of everything there and lead the battalion." When I arrived, I took full command of the battalion and began working with everyone who was left. Essentially, we didn't have an order to withdraw from Mariupol. We had an order to defend the battalion's position so that no one could enter it, because there was a lot of equipment in the battalion and a lot of personnel files for our unit.
Please tell me about the Russians who first took you as a prisoner, the ones who didn't give you food for 27 days, and also those in the first detention center in Olenivka. What was their morale like? How did they see the war at that time? This was essentially the beginning, and they had already suffered heavy losses in personnel and equipment. What was their perception of everything that was happening?
They were very aggressive, but in Olenivka, those weren't Russians, they were people from Donetsk.
Separatists?
Yes, they were local residents who stayed behind when it all started, and they switched sides to the Russians.
And what was their perception?
They were angry that their country had abandoned them, hadn't helped them.
Which country abandoned them? Ukraine?
Yes, in their perception it was as if Ukraine had abandoned them, didn't help them, and so they had to switch sides to Russia. They said that Russia had given them a great deal. Many of them said that maybe they would like to return to Ukraine, but they can't anymore. I heard a lot of things like that they still have their Ukrainian passports. They hid them, hoping that when all this stops, they'll hide their Russian passports like normal citizens, pull out their Ukrainian ones and say, "I'm Ukrainian, glory to Ukraine." In other words, they know how to adapt to the circumstances.
Actually, it's a pretty complicated question of what to do about all this. One day when Russia breaks up into smaller countries and everything looks like it's heading that way, there's this gut feeling that it will be a painful process for them, perhaps bloody, but things are moving toward Russia's collapse. And the time will come when we'll need to integrate these people into Ukrainian society. It won't be easy to determine who is good, who is bad, who should be tried and who shouldn't. Maybe there will be an amnesty for everyone, or maybe not. These are the challenges we'll face. However, no matter how difficult that may be, it's still better than war and everything that's happening right now. Were you afraid that you might be shot? And what was your state of mind, given that you realized you were now a prisoner and your life, in essence, belonged to those who had captured you?
Back then, at the very beginning, in 2014 and 2015, when everything was just getting started, we withdrew from Donetsk airport in 2015. In those days, I always carried a grenade with me and said that I would never surrender to captivity because I wouldn't give them the chance to humiliate me. All these years, I signed contracts with the brigades that were fighting in the Donetsk airport area. There are towns like Pisky, Opitna, and Avdiivka. They're all right next to Donetsk airport. And I knew that area very, very well. I knew all the minefields. I knew how to navigate and where the Russians were based. For my work, it was crucial to know where I could stop and where it was better not to stay. In 2022, when we were in Mariupol and the full-scale invasion began, I was more worried, not for myself, but for my guys. The last time I spoke with my commander of the 23rd Battalion, the only thing he said was, "Try to make sure all the guys stay alive." And I did everything I could to make sure that happened. We worked, we were constantly going out on missions. We were constantly in direct contact with the enemy. I did everything I could to keep everyone alive so that everyone would return or be able to return home.
But in captivity, you couldn't do that anymore.
Yes, I couldn't do that in captivity, but some of the guys were with me. We were moved around together through various prisons and I tried to help however I could. We supported each other morally with jokes and everything else. We told ourselves that everything would be okay, that we'd return home, and that's exactly what happened. We returned.
Is anyone else from your group still there?
Yes, there are still a few guys from our unit, from our battalion. We're currently trying and doing everything we can to get them back from captivity.
In total, over the entire time, you were transferred to 12 prisons. Could you please list them in order? Where were you held?
Yes, I was sent back to some of them repeatedly. Why that happened, I don't know myself.
So they sent you back to some prisons where you had already been?
For example, the first one was Olenivka, then it was the Donetsk Pretrial Detention Center, then it was Horlivka. From Horlivka, they transferred us to Kirovsk. From Kirovsk back to Olenivka, and from Olenivka back to Kirovsk. Every time we arrived, we had intake procedures. We spent some time in the pretrial detention center, after which we were transferred to so-called detachments. Then FSB representatives would come, conduct interrogations, and almost immediately afterward, we'd be transferred to another prison. After a while, we were transferred to yet another prison. They didn't want us to get used to the prison administration, and likewise, they didn't want the administration to get used to us, so that we couldn't establish any connection with Ukraine with their help.
And was Chuvashia your final destination?
Yes, Chuvashi was the final stop. That was Russia.
I'll ask you more about that later. As I understand it, you spent part of your time in prisons in the occupied territory of Ukraine and the rest in Russia. Was there a difference in how you were treated based on that?
Even when I was being transferred from prison to prison in the occupied territory of Ukraine, I knew we've arrived now, I just have to endure a few hours, the intake process will end, then I'll relax a bit and things will get a little easier. Usually this didn't last longer than 5 to 6 hours. That was the intake process. Then things would ease up, and for a few days no one bothered us if we did everything the administration told us to. Basically no one bothered us. In Russia it was a little different. They treated us very aggressively. That same intake lasted a whole day. They just processed us for 24 hours. First on the street, then inside a building, then in the hallway. It was really rough. They bring you in and you run out of the police van. Everyone walks in a line and there are already about 40 guards waiting for you. You run and they beat you the whole time. Then you run inside where they strip you. You have to undergo a medical exam, like to prove you're healthy. They took blood, weighed us, measured our height, checked us in every way, and the whole time they're shocking you with a stun gun. They just walk up and just hit you. And they hit so hard that some of them came up with these huge stun guns, huge ones with two prongs. After the shock, you fall right away. You're immediately disoriented. By the time I ended up in Chuvashia, I couldn't stand on one leg. They'd damaged my nerve endings at the second to last location, and I was already walking with crutches. But when we moved, they took them away from me. I was just hopping on one leg. They didn't care that I was on one leg. They didn't give a damn. They beat me just like everyone else. For example, there was an old man with me. He was 59, almost 60. An old man, you could tell he could barely move, barely walk. They just beat him senseless, and it was so painful to watch. A Russian guy, 28 or 30 years old, would walk up to him with no basic respect even for the elderly, and he just beat him up. He beat me up as a disabled person, and he beat him up, and it was just...
Why do you think he sees the world this way?
They were talking about it during intake. I only heard it because we weren't allowed to look. We kept our heads down the whole time and at some points even had our eyes closed. But I saw out of the corner of my eye that they were all wearing balaclavas. They were afraid we'd lift our heads and look at someone. They were afraid of our gaze so that we wouldn't be able to identify them later, to know who they were. But we heard it, and I heard it when the intake process was almost over. They had already started placing us in cells, and the Russians were saying that your nation must be destroyed so that we wouldn't exist at all, and that our land belongs to them. And it was so unpleasant to hear that the state, which once said we were a brotherly nation, that we had once signed some agreement that it would protect us, would go down this road.
Well, you know, they told us we were a brotherly nation, but to their own people, they told a slightly different story.
It's clear that they're running propaganda on TV saying that Ukraine is an aggressor state, that we attack them. Because when I first spoke with the FSB and was interrogated for the first time, it was really interesting. First they beat me up, sat me down on a chair and said, why did you attack Russia? Right? To which I replied, what do you mean? He's like, what do you mean? Wait, I say, I was at home. He's like, what do you mean at home? I say, well, I was at home. You came to me and took me away. I mean, I didn't say they took me there in the middle of a battle. I said I was at home and you took me from my home. He sat there, didn't know what to do. So they beat me up really badly again. And then he asked again, why did you attack Russia? I said, but I was at home. I didn't attack anyone. I was on my own land. After that, he calmed down a bit and started asking about my rank, what I did and which unit I was in. They're all heavily brainwashed by propaganda that it wasn't Russia who attacked Ukraine, But Ukraine attacked Russia to seize some borders, even though that didn't happen.
Basically, the whole world that has access to even the most basic media saw at least that, and the Russians saw Putin's speech on the eve of the invasion about how he was launching this special military operation. We didn't start it, he did. This is concrete evidence for the International Court of Justice in The Hague, where this case will eventually end up. This man shouldn't just die, he has to face his trial, and Russia itself has to realize what it has done and where it has ended up during his rule. But those are prospects for the future. Of the 12 prisons you were in, which was the hardest, the most difficult for you, and which was the easiest? Describe the best conditions and the worst conditions.
The absolute worst was Gorlivka. The regime there was very harsh at the time. The guards would just come in, constantly torment us, constantly rummage through our belongings, constantly turned everything inside out. At that time, we were able to receive care packages from our families. That was at the beginning. And in every unit, there was a phone. A supply officer was designated, and the unit leader was chosen by the prisoners. It wasn't just that they were appointed, so you'll be the supply officer. He was responsible for cleanliness and order in the unit. He handled various matters. For example, the guys might receive some candies, and the guards would call and say, pick out the best candies you have and bring it to us, if there weren't any. And often that was exactly the case, that there really wasn't anything to give them, so the day would go smoothly, the whole group would come and just turn the entire unit upside down. While the unit was being turned upside down, we'd stand outside in the local sector and just do physical exercises. We do physical exercises. There's this concept called one and a half, meaning we did everything in a half squat position off the ground.
What is a unit?
A unit consisted of about 100 to 102 men. It was a two-floor living space. The beds were lined up like this.
Two-floor?
Yes, two-floor. In one detachment, there was a mess hall, a clothing room, and a toilet. Showers were completely forbidden for us. We only had a toilet and a washroom.
And where did you wash?
We were taken to wash once a week in a bathhouse, which lasted 2 minutes. That is, 52 people would rush into 6 to 8 shower stalls in a single room. There were 6 shower heads. Sometimes there weren't even those, just a regular pipe with cool water.
All 50 of those people had to wash in 2 minutes?
Yes. Wash up, run out, get dressed quickly. Sometimes people would grab their things and run straight out onto the street, where they'd try to get dressed quickly so no one would beat them.
And if they didn't make it in time, they were beaten?
Yes. Mealtime was the same. We would run into the dining hall and could get hit right at the entrance. So you run in and get hit with the baton on the shoulders, on the head, on the kidneys, on the legs. You run in, quickly take a seat at the table and sit down on command. Those in charge of serving stand up and hand out the food they've set out there. You also have a limited time to eat it. If you don't finish in time, you're not allowed to eat anything after they say stop eating, because then they'd force you to leave the dining hall on your knees. All leftover food was thrown into a special bin, and then you had to leave.
How long did all this take?
The longest it took was 4 minutes. It was lunch. It was some kind of soup. I remember it was scalding hot, and some undercooked porridge with chicken bones. It was as if there wasn't even any meat, just bones. And in 4 minutes, you had to eat that scalding hot stuff. When you're hungry, you just shove it down. But by the time you get back to the unit, the skin on the roof of your mouth peels off. It just wouldn't heal. Every time, after every meal, we'd have to peel it off. It was boiling water, but you had to eat something.
And the best conditions, if you can call them that?
The best conditions were during our second term in Olenivka. There were 82 of us, and it was like a work detail, carrying out repairs and various restoration work. Every day we pulled weeds, painted, did various things. The living conditions were somewhat simplified. They practically left us alone. Right at the beginning, as soon as we arrived there, there was an intake process, but after that no one bothered us anymore. They only bothered those who had done something wrong. You are constantly on the move, they give you some kind of work, assign a guard to watch you constantly, and you do that work. 5, 7 or 8 people would do the exact same job. For example, we had to pull out grass that was taller than us. They didn't give us gloves for this. They didn't give us anything. And you just yanked it out of the ground. You cut your hands on that grass. They were constantly bleeding, but nobody did anything bad to you. They didn't help, but they didn't beat us either. So you just did your work in silence and they left you alone.
As we say, thanks even for that, right?
Right.
What about the Chuvash Republic? Because this is the first time I've met someone who was there. What was the attitude like there?
The attitude there was significantly worse, because when we got there, the intake process lasted a full day, and only then we were assigned to cells. Every day in the morning and in the evening, we'd run out into the hallway one by one, line up and assume the star position with our heads towards the wall. Then they changed it, and you had to run out bent over, keeping your head at knee level and with your hands raised all the way up. They used to show a movie on TV about the Black Dolphin prison and the transfer of the very most dangerous prisoners. That's exactly how it happened to us in Chuvashia. We ran dolphin style, eyes constantly closed. We weren't allowed to open them. Sometimes the guards even walked around with a mirror to check whether your eyes were closed or not. If they saw someone's eyes open, they'd immediately start shocking them with electricity.
And how do you walk with your eyes closed?
One by one, we would bump our heads against each other and try to stay in line that way. The first one would go out and we'd follow right behind him and line up against the wall.
Okay, there's someone in front of you, you're holding onto their head and you know where to go, but the first one still has to figure out where and how to move.
We learned this because they beat us up a few times and we already knew how to run out, how to stand and how to run back. Sometimes we'd bump our heads, fall and stumble, but we tried to do it in a way that we'd get beaten less for it.
I'd open and close my eyes a little bit to see the direction.
Something like that, but very, very quickly.
What was the food like in there?
Food, if you can call it that, soup that looked like water, some undercooked porridge, about a handful. There might have been potatoes, 1 or 2 spoonfuls. The only worth thing was bread, more or less decent, normal bread. It was baked right there on the premises, and we could always smell it when it was baking. There was also fruit compote or tea that you could drink.
Was there any kind of holiday ration on holidays?
In the 3 years I spent in all the penal colonies, I was once very surprised that on Easter in Chuvashia, the cell door opened and a priest came in. We were lined up right in the cell. No one took us anywhere. And the priest gave each of us a small Easter cake. And that shocked us, because then the guards said we could lift our heads and open our eyes. We saw the priest in the cell and he approached each of us and gave us a small Easter cake.
Like a small personal one?
Yes.
That must have been the tastiest thing you've eaten in all 3 years.
Yes, it was so sweet, so delicious. It was just unbelievable. Well, the guards told us right away that we had an hour and a half to make sure nothing was left of it. No crumbs, no food allowed in the cell. And when they left and the cell door closed, we pounced on those Easter cakes so eagerly that we just ate and felt pure bliss from it. That's the only thing that was really that powerful.
Actually, I've heard various similar stories. Sometimes a priest would come at Easter and give one egg for the whole cell, and the guys there would share that egg, eat it, and then the special forces would rush in and beat them even more than usual. There were stories like that. This is the first time I've heard that they actually gave them Easter bread and didn't even beat them for it. That's cool. That's probably how it should have been if they were just a little more civilized.
For example, in Olenivka, when I first ended up there, it happened to be Easter too. They took us out there, our unit, to clean up, where we were pulling weeds with our bare hands. And there was a huge trash pile there. About 5 or 6 containers were throwing the trash, and next to it they were burning the weeds we'd pulled, and we saw a lot of Easter cakes in one of those bins. The guards were standing with us and said, if we see anyone take even one of those, you'll be in very, very big trouble. And we understood, we saw that they were small, we understood that they were for us, that they had been sent by some people or volunteers. They just tossed them into the bin. I mean, they just threw them away, even though they could have just given them to the prisoners. They could have taken them, kept them for a day, and given them to the people, but they just threw that bread away.
I'll let that go for now. What's going on in their heads? But what do you think? Was this a grassroots initiative by the guards themselves, or did they receive an order from above not to give the Ukrainian soldiers anything under any circumstances?
Honestly, I don't even understand who could tell them to do that, but they aren't human. I mean, there's nothing human left in them. If there ever was, there isn't now.
Well, never mind. At the exit of this supermarket, checkout counter awaits them where they'll have to pay the bills. I urge you to subscribe to our channel and comment on our videos because that's how you can support us and our work. When I asked you off camera what helped you get through those 3 years of captivity, you said it was your grandmother who is now 95 years old. Is she doing well?
Yes, thank God. She lived to see it.
Tell me a little more about this story. Why your grandmother specifically?
I don't have parents. My mom left us a long time ago when I was still a kid. My dad died in 2017 while I was at war. He had cancer. I have only my grandmother left, who is 95 years old now, and I was very, very worried that if she found out I was a prisoner of war, she'd be devastated and God forbid something might happen to her. For a while, I couldn't get home because of the interrogations and my medical treatment. But when I was finally able to go home, I bought a huge bouquet. I went to my grandmother's house, saw her, and gave her the bouquet. She said she had been waiting as best she could and had finally waited for me to come home. That's what I was most worried about, that I'd come home and there would be no one there.
Did you even manage to get in touch with her?
Yes, there was one prison where during a conversation, one of the guards asked me who was waiting for me at home. I said my grandmother is, but I was really worried that she probably couldn't take it and had died. After a while, this guard came back and said to me, come on, you're going to help me with something. I went with him to the industrial zone. We went out and he said, your grandmother sends her best regards. And he described the female caregiver who was with her. He said she was doing well and was really looking forward to seeing me and loved me very much. He gave me a pack of cigarettes and a box of matches. I was so touched by this. I even started crying. He said, I told her that you're doing fine, that everything's okay, and that you'll be going home soon. I was so, so grateful to him, but he begged me not to let anyone find out about this, because otherwise he could end up in prison just like me. They could put him in jail for treason.
This is a partial answer to a question I often hear from foreigners. When I talk at meetings about the prisoners, about their stories, one of the most common questions they ask is, was there at least one good person among the Russians, someone who helped or did something positive? I understand their logic because they want to find at least something good in them. They can't accept this image of such total evil as we perceive it. But sometimes it happens that a single person can actually do some small thing, understanding and realizing that he might face the same punishment as the prisoner himself.
When we were in Horlivka, guy was brought to my unit along with the prisoners. He was a former guard at the detention center. When the guys recognized him, they really wanted to beat him up badly because he had tormented our people. And when I spoke to him, I asked him why he was here. And he said it was because the FSB had seen his correspondence that he was writing to a girl from Ukraine and she was in the military. They loved each other, but she stayed on this side of the front line and he stayed on the other side. They had been communicating for a very long time, but the FSB saw this correspondence and put him in prison.
He's communicating with a girl from Ukraine. He loves her. Everything's fine. But at the same time, he hates other Ukrainians who are in captivity who are just like him. And for him, that's normal, that he doesn't have that dissonance, that something's wrong here. If you already hate Ukrainians, then why are you communicating with a Ukrainian girl? That's just how it is. Besides your grandmother, what else kept you going? You told the story about your leg, that you couldn't walk. Did the other guys support you during your time there?
Yes, my comrade constantly supported me. He helped me all the time. When I didn't have crutches at first to get around on one leg, it was hard for me, but he helped me constantly. He was always by my side. When they separated us, I went to Chuvashia and he was still in Kirovsk. I think during the second phase, he was even transferred to my cell. I was very happy about that. Turned out that I was the first to return from captivity, but he returned too just recently, and I gathered some candy, cookies and cigarettes for him, sent it to him and called him. The first thing I told him was that I was glad he'd finally returned. He's also from near Venezia. He lives in the Venezia region. I'm going to help him now, just as he helped me so much in prison. I'm going to help him rehabilitate, get back on his feet, and undergo the treatment I know he needs and how it should be done, so that everything goes smoothly.
You know, I've heard the opinion many times, and I agree with it, that the strongest friendships are with the people you studied with in college or served with in the military. If you served together and overcame obstacles together, then these are the people with whom you'll stay in touch throughout your life. There might not be many of them, but that's just how it is. How do you see this situation now? The person who helped you while you were in captivity, will they be your friend for life now?
Yes, for life, because in early 2014, I had friends, I had acquaintances, but after 2014, they were at home, they weren't fighting. When I came back again, I had a three-month break before my next contract to rest. It was September 2015. I arrived and met up with friends a few times and realized that I didn't understand them and they didn't understand me. Then I went to see the friends who had been with me, who had fought with me, and we were always getting together, always going somewhere on vacation. And I realized that these were my friends, not the ones who stayed at home, afraid to go anywhere or do anything for their country.
This is another one of those, I don't know how to properly call it, little tragedies of a Ukrainian soldier, of those who joined the armed forces. Your social circle changes completely, and I can confirm this from my own life experience. Those people you considered friends before you joined the armed forces, they just somehow remained in the past. Whether you wanted that or not, it just happened. You made new friends with whom you started spending time. This is a very common situation. For so many Ukrainian men, life has changed in this way. Try to understand this. Try to imagine that all those friends you have now, at some point they just disappear because you simply have nothing to talk to them about anymore. You have a completely different life.
But these are much better friends, because you can call them anytime and say, man, I'm feeling bad. And at any time, they'll just say, tell us where you are and we'll come. And it's true, that's how it is. It's awesome.
That's really cool, yeah. How about some funny stories? Did anything like that happen to you during your time in prison?
Yeah, sure. We were always joking around, but we did it on the sly. We knew we were constantly being watched and listened to, so we were very, very careful about everything. For example, even in Chuvashia, after the beatings, we'd run into the cell, and when we heard they were already dealing with another cell, we'd start joking around, like, that guard didn't beat us up too badly today. I'm sure my mom or grandma beat me way harder when I was a kid. The guard's shifts changed every day, but we already knew how each of them beat people. We knew that, for example, on this particular day, it would be more or less normal. We'd get a light beating, but the next day we'd have to brace ourselves a bit because those guards would beat us much harder.
So basically most of the jokes and conversations were actually about the beatings?
Well, not just about the beatings. For example, when they came to work, you could already tell by their perfume who had arrived, because our sense of smell was very acute, since we could hardly smell anything either in the cell or outside. For a long time, we hadn't eaten anything salty, sugary, or sweet. All of that heightened our senses. It developed to the point where even by sound we could hear very clearly even the slightest rustle. Smells. A guard might enter the cell. We couldn't see him, but we knew who it was just by the smell, just by the scent of his perfume. We could already tell roughly who exactly had come in. Why is he here today? It's not his shift today. He's been replaced, so today will be fine. We already knew there wouldn't be much beating that day. There was another interesting moment in Chuvashia a month before I was exchanged. A Chechen took over the shift. He walked around without a mask. And on his first day, our first cell was being opened. The cell was being opened. Of course, we were standing in a single line in the dolphin position. And one of the guards started beating us, but he stopped him right away. He says, what are you doing? And the guard replies, well, the usual. The Chechen replied, no, I forbid you to beat them. If you want to beat someone, go to the front line. This isn't the front line. They're unarmed. They're serving their time so they can be exchanged. I forbid you to touch them. We really remembered that the Chechen actually showed some respect for the military, for all soldiers, because he's a soldier himself. He fought in the Chechen war. He fought against Ukraine. But as he said, he has a sense of honor toward the military. In battle, it's battle. But here, there's no reason to touch them.
Actually, I've also heard of cases where, for some reason, the Chechens behaved more reasonably. I heard a story from Horlivka where a Chechen Special Forces unit arrived, and they treated the prisoners normally, better than anyone expected, but there are extremes in the other direction. When there were Kadyrovtsi or others, they could abuse even more. It depends on the person. Some have honor, some don't. What was the hardest for you, psychologically and physically?
At one point, when they started bringing new prisoners to Kirovsk, some of them were conscripts, and I spoke with one of them. After they had served their isolation period in the pit, they were moved up to the unit. And when I was talking to him, we got to know each other. And he asked me how many days or weeks I'd been here. I said, I've been here for over 2 years, almost three. And he was like, what do you mean? I said, I've been here since Mariupol, from Mariupol. He asked, and I said, well, I was captured back in Mariupol. He said, but we were told that everyone from Mariupol had been exchanged a long time ago. I was just sitting there, and I realized that, yes, indeed, there were a lot of us from Mariupol there, and they aren't exchanging us. And then, for example, one day they'd pick out guys for an exchange, all the conscripts who'd been there for 5, 4, or 7 months. While those from Mariupol, who'd been sitting there for 2.5 years, were still in prison. And it bothered me so much that they simply didn't want to exchange us, specifically the Mariupol guys. We were like a bone in the Russians' throat. They'd been trying to capture us for a very long time, and we didn't understand why they weren't exchanging us, but were exchanging the conscripts. And that was hard to accept, because if at the beginning, roughly speaking, they had exchanged us, if Ukraine had exchanged us, I think I would have gone on to fight. I wouldn't have stopped. I would have gone to train as an officer, and I would have gone on to lead some units and continue participating. Since I spent such a long time in captivity, I've lost a lot of my health, and it takes a lot of time to recover. I understand that at this stage I simply can't go back there. You know, I'd like to do what they did in China, build a great wall.
A great wall with a big sign that says, get the hell away from us.
Some believe the war started in 2022.
An extended version of this conversation is available on Patreon, so please subscribe and help us translate it into as many languages as possible so that more people can learn about what Russia is doing against Ukraine.